treaties that are reported to us in our sources. The treaties, however, are highly disputed, and some scholars are very sceptical, especially of the first one. They say, why would Carthage pay any attention to what was really then an extremely regional, extremely unimportant place at the end of the 6th century BC? Why would they be interested in Rome at this time? Our main source for this first treaty is Polybius, who states its contents and says that it was visible in Rome of his day. He says that he could go and see the treaty, a copy of which was visible in one of the public buildings in Rome in his day. Other sources, however, mention that the first treaty between Rome and Carthage was the one of 348 BC, and so there is this dispute. How many treaties were there between Rome and Carthage? When was the first one, and so forth? But I think that the testimony of Polybius is extremely important. It's very difficult to discount what Polybius says. He's very reliable, tends to be a very reliable source. And before throwing Polybius out, I think we have to have good reason. So if he says that he saw a treaty between Rome and Carthage that dated to the first year of the Republic, then that has to be taken seriously. And one of the pieces of evidence, this is just a very much an aside, a matter of the way evidence can sometimes be quite congruent, a piece of evidence that turned up quite recently seemed to confirm that this is indeed possible, that there was a treaty between Rome and Carthage as early as the end of the 6th century. At the town of Perigi, on the coast of Etruria, some temples were located, Etruscan temples, and in those temples were found 3 gold tablets, which recorded various religious donations. 2 of the tablets were in Etruscan, and one of them was in Punic, in the language of the Carthaginians. This would seem to suggest then that the Carthaginians did have an interest in the area of the western coast of central Italy as early as the 6th century BC, because these tablets date to about 500 BC. So that the Romans and Carthaginians could have had a treaty as early as 500 BC, I think, is not unreasonable. The thrust of all of these treaties, so far as we can see, was to delineate a sphere of influence. The Carthaginians agreed that they would not interfere directly on the mainland of Italy, and the Romans agreed that they would not interfere outside of the mainland of Italy. So these are non-aggression pacts, pacts that allow you to establish spheres of influence. So here's one state then, Carthage, who is taking notice of Roman rise to power. It wouldn't be surprising if Carthaginian trading interests seemed to have extended up into the western seaboard of Italy. Wouldn't be surprising then for Carthage, at least, to pay attention to what's going on with the rise of Rome, and apparently trying to secure Roman cooperation in establishing spheres of interest. The other major state that paid any attention to Rome's rise to power was Ptolemaic Egypt, which in 273 BC declared friendship with Rome. This is an important date because it's 2 years after the withdrawal of Pyrrhus from Italy. So clearly, the failure of Pyrrhus to defeat the Romans and carve out for himself a little Italian empire in the southwestern portion of Italy drew the attention of the Ptolemies. Pyrrhus, by the way, and Epirus are another one of the smaller Hellenistic states, another one of the smaller Hellenistic kingdoms that was around at the time. And it obviously drew the attention of the Ptolemies that a well-organized state like Epirus, fighting in the Macedonian style, had failed to defeat Rome decisively, and therefore in 273 BC the Ptolemies declared friendship with the Romans. We'll see that this was one of the smartest things that the Ptolemies ever did. By declaring friendship with the Romans at this early stage, they avoided the military attention of the legions right down to 31 BC, and as a result the Ptolemaic dynasty of Egypt was the longest lived of the Hellenistic kingdoms. While the other Hellenistic kingdoms were being crushed by the legions, the Ptolemies were friends of the Roman people, and so they avoided that fate, at least until the 1st century BC. But even then, we'll see that the fate of the Ptolemies ultimately was tied up with the internal workings of the Roman state and the development of the Roman Revolution. All of that, however, yet to come. The situation then in the Mediterranean world prior to the emergence of Rome as a major power is a complicated one. There are many states, especially in the eastern half of the Mediterranean Sea, many highly organized, urbanized, sophisticated states with a long heritage of civilization and independent statehood behind them, with the immediate heritage of Alexander the Great's conquests behind them, and at the time that the Romans were to emerge onto the international scene, mutually antagonistic, not successfully getting on with each other. In the Western Mediterranean, as we've seen, there was the major mercantile power of Carthage, the details of which we will look at the beginning of the next lecture. But if you were a betting person, if you had some drachmas or shekels to put down on a table on the wager, who in the next 100 years will be the major power of the Mediterranean, and you're making this wager around 270 BC, you'd have to be especially percipient to have picked the Romans. The smart money would surely have been on one of the major powers of the Eastern Mediterranean, the Ptolemies, perhaps the Seleucids with their vast resources drawn from Asia. Or possibly you could have chosen the power of Carthage, although that would be, I think, a rather less safe bet, since the Carthaginian interests, as we'll see, were primarily mercantile rather than centered on the issue of power and power holding. One of the reasons that you'd have to be especially percipient to pick the Romans was that the Romans in the period prior to the First Punic War were not a major naval power. If you were to control the Mediterranean Sea, you were going to need to have a navy. This is why the Carthaginians or any of the large powers of the Eastern Mediterranean would be good bets, but the Romans not necessarily so. They did have a navy of sorts for coastal defense. Naturally enough, even if you are a land-based power in Italy, you will need to defend your coast at some degree, and they had fought naval battles, most notably at the end of the 4th century BC, the Battle of Antium, which actually has a good story attached to it, because after that battle, the Romans sawed off the ramming beaks of the enemy ships, which they had captured. They sawed them off and brought them back to Rome as trophies, and they attached them to the speaker's platform in the Roman Forum. And the Latin word for beaks, which is what describes the large bronze ramming fronts of ancient warships, was rostra, meaning the beaks. And so we get our word rostrum for any speaker's platform. It actually means beak. Strange, but that's the reason why. So the Romans did have a naval capacity of sorts, but it could not in any way have matched the serious naval powers of, say, Carthage, which had an extensive trading, I won't say trading empire, but extensive trading interests that stretched all the way from Spain, covered as well parts of Sardinia, and as we've seen, showed an interest in the status of affairs in the on mainland Italy, especially in the central area. In the Eastern Mediterranean was, as I've said before, the powerful navy of Rhodes, and the Seleucids could marshal a powerful navy from their Phoenician underlings, from their Phoenician subjects. So the absence of a Roman naval power would be one of the chief reasons why I suppose most people at the time didn't pay much attention to the growth of Roman power. It would seem to have been a very regional thing. It's going to affect the people of Italy, but we over here in Turkey or in Syria are quite safe. How wrong indeed they were to be. And it was to be, in fact, Carthage that was to make the first mistake of rousing Roman wrath, and it is to the First Punic War and the epic, titanic struggle that that involves that we will turn our attention in the next lecture.
Lecture 12, Carthage and the First Punic War.
Hello and welcome to the 12th lecture in the history of Rome. We have now surveyed the rise of Roman power on mainland Italy. We have set the stage for the expansion of Rome in the East Mediterranean by looking at the international scene as it looked around 270 or so BC. It's now time to turn our attention to the actual expansion of Rome in the Mediterranean, a rapid and remarkable event in the history of the world, noted by contemporaries, which we will first of all outline in the next few lectures and then eventually tried to seek explanations for at a later lecture. Rome's rise to dominance can broadly be divided into two halves. First of all, dealing with the Western Mediterranean and specifically the city of Carthage. And then in the second half, in the second phase, turning its attention to the highly developed Hellenistic half of the Eastern Mediterranean in the period beginning around 200 BC or so. So if Rome's conflict with Carthage starts in 264, the first 60 years really seeing Rome concentrating on the Western Mediterranean, and then the subsequent 60 years seeing Rome concentrating on the Eastern Mediterranean. It falls quite nicely into two chronological phases. First of all, however, we will deal with Carthage. We will outline the nature of the Carthaginian state, examine how it was that Rome and Carthage first came into conflict, outline the course of the war, and then discuss the ramifications for both Rome and Carthage of this, the First Punic War. Carthage, by tradition, was founded in 814 BC by the Phoenicians, although archaeology reveals nothing earlier than the mid-8th century at the site, so that date is open to question. It was founded by Phoenician traders, whom the Romans called Puni, and hence the name of these wars is the Punic Wars. The Romans called the Carthaginians Phoenicians, Puni, in their language all the time, and so that's why we speak about the Punic Wars, not the Carthaginian Wars. It was located on a magnificent harbour, highly recommended as a place to visit. If you ever get a chance to visit North Africa, I can recommend Tunisia highly. Carthage is located on a superb natural harbour with a fertile hinterland, and when we add into the mix an enterprising population such as the Phoenicians, then the city was quickly to rise to some position of influence in the Western Mediterranean. By the 6th century BC, the Carthaginians already had established trading posts all along the coast of North Africa towards the Atlantic Ocean, as well as on Sicily, Sardinia, Corsica, and Spain. Their traditional enemies in the region were the Greek colonies of Sicily, particularly Syracuse, and the Carthaginians and the Syracusans and some other Greek states there fought a long series of wars for control of the island, which were still unresolved in the 3rd century BC. A sort of balance of power in Sicily, however, pertained by this date, with the Carthaginians, broadly speaking, in control of the western half of the island and the Greeks, especially Syracuse, in control of the eastern half of the island of Sicily. Carthage maintained her overseas interests through a mixture of diplomacy, backed by a large naval capacity and mercenary armies. This was because Carthage was run predominantly by mercantile families and mercantile interests, and had a shape in terms of its government, so far as we can make it out, that is quite analogous to the Roman Republic. There was a oligarchy of leading families, grouped together in a sort of a Senate-like council. This had evolved, it appears, from an earlier form of autocracy when a king-like figure called a governor had been in control. So, right like the Roman Republic, the Carthaginians appear to have moved from monarchy to a sort of oligarchic system of government. But these ruling families had a Senate-like council, and they had every year two leading magistrates who they called shofets, Suffetes in Latin, who were sort of like the consuls. There was also a popular assembly of adult male citizens, the function of which remains obscure to us. But a very unusual feature of the Carthaginian state was a permanent standing court of 104 lifetime members, whose job it was to scrutinize the activity of public officials and generals who were hired or sent out on Carthaginian business. Rather like Darth Vader, the Carthaginians did not take well to failure by their underlings, and it was quite common for them to crucify generals or admirals who failed in their tasks, especially if they were deemed by this court to have been negligent in any way, or worse, if they had been taking bribes or something. So quite tough taskmasters, and the officials kept in play, kept on their toes by this 104 lifetime member court of officials. Carthaginian motivation was driven by merchant-like interests of profit and cost-effectiveness. this is what really drove, stimulated the Carthaginians in all of their actions. And this differed considerably from Roman stimuli, from Roman motivations. Carthage, in some ways, was run like a large company. I often describe it to my students as Carthage Inc. They are interested in using their navy, but only to back up their trade interests. It seems that every year the profits of the state were totted up and shared out among the citizens. It's almost like shareholders. It's rather a crude analogy, but nonetheless there's some truth to it. They would resort to war when it was necessary, but if they could find a peaceful solution through diplomacy or threats, they would prefer to do that. War, after all, was costly, and that's the last thing that the Carthaginians wanted to face, was a costly endeavour. In contrast, the Romans were motivated more by socio-political concerns. They were concerned to maintain loyalty with their allies. They were concerned to maintain face in the face of their allies. Cost-effectiveness was not something that featured heavily in the Roman motivation and agenda. So it was then that in the middle of the 3rd century BC, these two states, one the land-bound state of Rome, the other the mercantile naval-based state of Carthage, faced each other now in close proximity, especially across the straits of Messina between Sicily and mainland Italy, where the Romans were in control. And the way that they came into conflict, these two great states came into conflict, is almost ludicrous, and it was indirect. It's worth looking at this cause of the war in some detail just to see, as an illustration of how historical contingency from apparently minor incidents can lead to, in fact, titanic and serious consequences. It seems that around 288 or 289 BC, a group of Italian adventurers from the area of Campania, who call themselves the Sons of Mars, Mamertines, they call themselves the Mamertines, were in the employ of one of the rulers of Syracuse. When this ruler died, they found themselves out of work and began marching up the eastern coast of Sicily to make their way home to southern Italy. When they reached the town of Messana, which is in the very northeastern corner of Sicily, across the straits from Rhegium on the mainland of Italy, they changed their plan. They liked the look of this place. This was a Greek city-state, and the local rulers of Messana took them in as guests, put them up in their houses, and generally treated them very well. In repayment, the Mamertines, on an agreed-upon night, cut the throats of their hosts, robbed all their possessions and their wives, and seized control of the town of Messana. For the next 20 or so years, they took advantage of the Syracusan and Carthaginian conflicts on Sicily to carve out for themselves a sort of brigand kingdom in the northeastern corner of Sicily. They even had the temerity to issue coinage as if they were a real and legitimate state, so they obviously had high aspirations for themselves, even if they were to overlook their rather ignominious origins. But as the Greeks increasingly looked like coming out on top in the conflict with Carthage over Sicily, the position of the Mamertines in Messana grew increasingly more perilous. Eventually, they began to fear that the Syracusans would attack them and punish them, since most of their victims in forming their brigand kingdom had been Greeks. So, they appealed to a nearby Carthaginian fleet and commander for assistance in 266 BC. The Carthaginian naval commander brought his ships into the harbour at Messana and took Messana under the protection of Carthage. The Syracusans, who were threatening the Mamertines, decided that it wasn't worth fighting a full-scale war against Carthage over these desperados in Messana, and backed off. And that would really have been that, if it hadn't been for a strange decision on the part of the Mamertines. For whatever reason, we wish we knew why, they felt uncomfortable under the Carthaginian protection. And they appealed across the Straits of Messana to a Roman garrison on the mainland at the town of Rhegium. They appealed for assistance. They used as the basis of their appeal the fact that they were Italian mainlanders. They were, you know, Italians like you Romans, that they worshipped the same gods, unlike those foreign Carthaginians who worshipped their own gods. Here we are, the Sons of Mars. Mars, after all, was the ancestral deity of the Roman people. Remember, he was supposed to be the father of Romulus. So they made all these emotional appeals to the Romans, who, after a heated debate in the Senate, decided to accept Messana under the Mamertines into the friendship of the Roman people. The technical term is fides, into the faith, loyalty, area of influence of the Roman people. This was a momentous decision. It didn't seem like so at the time, but it was, in fact, a momentous decision. Because the Romans then moved a small garrison over to Messana, and the Mamertines and the Romans combined forced the Carthaginian commander to withdraw. You can imagine the reception he received when he returned to Carthage. Having been judged to have behaved stupidly, he was crucified. But the Syracusans still wanted to exact their vengeance on the Mamertines, and now they actually allied with their former enemies, the Carthaginians, to attack the Mamertines in Messana. But remember now, the Messanians are under the control, or at least under the protection, of the Romans. And this is how, indirectly, when the Syracusan and Carthaginian force attacked the Messanians, the Romans felt themselves obligated to defend their new friends. And as a result, Roman and Punic forces came into conflict over, really, people who were, to all intents and purposes, gangsters. Quite ludicrous. The conflict started in 264 BC, and it's not my intention to go over the details of this war and all its various aspects, but we will outline its course, dividing it into three main phases. We will also pause on occasion to look at illustrative events that show us the nature of the war, the enormous efforts that were expended on both sides in its prosecution, and to draw out some of the dramatic nature of this huge struggle between Carthage and Rome that lasted from 264 to 241 BC, the First Punic War. The first phase of the war, the first 4 years from 264 to 260, were fought on land in Sicily. This is where the Carthaginians had traditionally always done their fighting, in the area of Italy. And the Romans, of course, had been drawn into Sicilian affairs via the Mamertines at Messana. And so the first battles took place on land over Sicily. Whatever the reason, by the way, for the start of the war, whatever about the Mamertines and the beginning of the war, once the war started, they were forgotten. Now it quickly evolved into a struggle between Carthage and Rome for control of Sicily. So the original war aims were forgotten. If it was trying to restore the Mamertines and save them, forget that. They vanished from history. Now it's fighting for control of Sicily. Another typical feature of wars, they often escalate in their goals once they've started. Anyhow, the salient event in this particular phase of the war is the capture by storm by the Romans of the fortified town of Agrigentum in the south coast of Sicily. I've been to this place. It's a very, very formidable fortified location. Quite remarkable to think that the Romans could have taken it by assault, by direct frontal assault. But they did, in 262, drove out the Carthaginians who were there. And this was such a terrifying event for the Carthaginians that they, for the rest of the war, they avoided any direct open battle with the legions as a result of this event. They figured that the Romans were, if they could do that, that they were not going to be easy people to beat on the field. However, despite having defeated the Carthaginians on land, the Romans quickly realized that they were going to have to develop some form of naval capacity if they were to actually win the war, since Carthage could simply resupply their forces in Sicily by sea. The Romans at this stage were not a major naval power, as we saw at the end of the last lecture. So in 260 BC, they built a massive fleet from scratch. The story goes that they built it on the model of a captured Carthaginian warship. There's reason to doubt that particular story, since we have seen that the Romans did have a form of coastal defense prior to the Punic Wars, but it does make for a good story, sort of the first example of an arms race, military secrets, how to build a seafaring naval warship. We'll capture a Carthaginian ship and copy it, but that story might well be untrue. But once the Romans had built their fleet, we enter the second phase of the war, stretches from 260 to 255 BC, and sees the Romans, remarkably, in their first naval engagement, the first major naval engagement, emerging victorious. This is the Battle of Mylae off the coast of Sicily in 260 BC. They did this primarily by developing a technology that allowed them to transfer their land-based superiority onto the seas. They developed a mechanism called the Raven, the Corvus, which is essentially a large bridge on a swivel that has a spike at the far end of it. And whereas the traditional form of warfare was to ram enemy ships and sink them, the Romans would draw up alongside the enemy ship, drop this bridge across, the spike would then impale itself in the enemy's vessel, in the deck of the enemy's vessel, tying the two ships together, and then the Romans would send their marines over, basically transforming the ships into platforms for land-style warfare, in which the Romans had the advantage. So confident were the Romans now that they got carried away with themselves and sent an invasion force into Africa in an attempt to attack Carthage directly. This invasion force left in 256 BC, and in 255 it was completely annihilated when it was ambushed in a valley near Carthage. This year also saw an enormous reversal of Roman fortunes in a most silly fashion. The Romans, despite the fact that they had built their navy and were developing themselves as a naval power, were not really accustomed to matters maritime, and they had left their large fleet exposed on the western side of Sicily when a three-day storm struck, and they lost 77% of their fleet to a storm. Now, to get an idea of the scale of that catastrophe, when the Japanese Imperial Navy attacked the U.S. Navy harbored at Pearl Harbor in 1941, the U.S. Navy lost 3% of its entire fleet, 26% of its war fleet. And that was considered to be an appalling catastrophe. In this storm, not even enemy action, the Romans lost 77% of their war fleet. This would have been enough for most states to have considered negotiating a peace, but in typical Roman fashion, they just knuckled down, and within 3 months, they had rebuilt their fleet. The final phase of the war stretches from this rebuilding of the Roman fleet in 255 to 241 BC, and is illustrative of the difference between Roman and Carthaginian motivations. The Carthaginians once again focused their attentions on Sicily. They decided to conduct guerrilla-style operations against Roman interests in Sicily, and fortified some naval bases and some land bases, and sent out raiding ships and land-based raiding parties to harry Roman lines of communication and Roman supply lines. This particular system of warfare seemed to be going very well for the Carthaginians, and they were finding the maintenance of their navy a somewhat burdensome affair. Remember, cost-effectiveness is one of their chief forms of motivation. Maintaining a large navy that isn't really being used was really quite expensive, and so as a result, they decided that they would demobilize large sections of their navy. Between 248 and 242 BC, while the land forces on Sicily are harrying the Roman lines of communication, the Carthaginians demobilize, they disperse much of their main naval force. In the same period, the Romans built 200 new ships. So, the longer the war dragged on then, the greater was the advantage given to the Romans. They were the ones who were interested in prevailing, in securing political and military dominance over areas of territory. The Carthaginians were interested in counting the shekels. How much is this costing us? And the longer the war dragged on, the less cost-effective the war was from the Carthaginian perspective. By the time the Carthaginians had realized that the Romans were now well equipped with a new navy, it was too late. They cobbled together as best they could a naval force and sent it out to try and tackle the new Roman fleet. The two fleets met at the Aegates Islands on the western seaboard of Sicily, just off the western seaboard of Sicily, and the Romans crushed the Carthaginian fleet. The Carthaginians were forced to surrender. This then was the first major overseas war that the Romans embarked upon. Its course, which we've just outlined, as you can see, was an epic one involving major defeats and successes for both sides, the fortunes of the war shifting to and fro. But what shines through again and again from reading about this struggle, and we'll be seeing it repeatedly as we look at Roman expansion across the rest of the Mediterranean, is the Roman sense of determination. Their dogged stubbornness to prevail in the face of sometimes overwhelming odds. Catastrophes that would have caused other states to consider perhaps negotiating a peace merely caused the Romans to knuckle down and work harder, to redouble their efforts. With the Carthaginians humiliated and defeated, the Romans imposed a vast war indemnity on the Carthaginian state. They hit them where it would hurt most in their money purses. They levied an indemnity of 3,200 talents of silver. One talent would have made any individual a millionaire in the ancient world, and here was a war indemnity of 3,200 talents. Carthage was also forced to cede all its interests in Sicily to Rome, who now adopted Sicily as its first overseas province. 241, Sicily becomes the first province of the Roman people. The Syracusans, who had wisely decided to side with Rome when push came to shove, were allowed to exist as an ally of the Roman people, but the rest of Sicily became a province, the first overseas province of the Roman Empire. In the years following the First Punic War, the Carthaginians got involved in a very silly conflict in their homeland with their own army. The Carthaginians were not a citizen-based militia like the Romans. In typical Carthaginian fashion, they hired their armies, they hired mercenary armies. Since they had lost the war against Rome, they found themselves unable to pay their mercenary armies, which were parked outside the city, and ended up having to fight them. They actually had to fight their own troops, so this was a great period of turmoil for the Carthaginian state. And the Romans took full advantage of the Carthaginians being so wrapped up in fighting their own mercenary army. And in 238 BC, they seized Corsica and Sardinia and annexed those two islands also as provinces of Rome. So by 238 BC then, the Romans had extended their power outside of Italy. They were now in control of Sicily, and they were now in control of Sardinia and Corsica. The First Punic War had major ramifications for both Rome and for Carthage. In the first place, the Romans had been drawn out of the Italian peninsula for the first time. Whereas before now, they had focused all their attentions on gaining ascendancy over the peoples of the mainland of Italy. Now, for the first time, they found themselves in control of territories outside of the mainland of the Italian peninsula. Secondly, and through circumstances forced on them by fighting the First Punic War, the Romans now found themselves in command of the largest navy, not just a navy, but the largest navy in the Mediterranean Sea. And in repeated battles, they had proven themselves to be successful in using this navy, even if they had shown their greenness from time to time, especially by exposing their fleet to a 3-day storm, which was to destroy it in 255. That's just a sign of their neophyte nature in matters naval. But by the end of the Punic War, of the First Punic War, they were fairly adept at naval matters and now possessed the largest fleet in the Mediterranean. It was with this fleet, of course, that they were able to annex the islands of Sardinia and Corsica in 238 BC. And above all, the Punic War shows us, as far as the Romans are concerned, shows us their attitude towards conflict. They will continue to fight for as long as they can. This would have been impossible for the Romans to do were it not for their confederation of Italy, as we've examined already. Were it not for the enormous resources of manpower that they could draw upon to send armies into Sicily, to send armies across to Africa, to build, man a fleet, all of that was founded in the success of Rome in organizing the Italian mainland in their confederacy. Their sheer doggedness to fight on, really a cardinal feature of Roman imperialist policy. For the Carthaginians, the defeat at the hands of the Romans was humiliating, to be sure, but it also had some very important ramifications. They were debarred now from their traditional sphere of influence in the Tyrrhenian Sea. Sicily now belonged to the Romans. Roman fleets patrolled the seas between Sicily and Sardinia and Corsica. This is where we have seen the Carthaginians were traditionally most interested, in this area of the sea. Now they were effectively shut out from any operations, trading or otherwise, in that area of the Mediterranean. So they looked westward. Between 241 and 220 BC, under a leading Carthaginian family called the Barcas, they carved out for themselves a small empire in southeastern Spain. This they did, again, largely with mercenary armies and with naval support from their fleets, which hadn't been annihilated by the Romans, but had been limited by them and defeated by them. But they were still able to supply an army in Spain, which over the course of the next 20 or so years carved out quite a profitable empire for themselves in Spain. Plenty of natural resources in Spain to exploit, gold mines, silver mines, lots of natural resources, and of course very effective fighting troops in the form of Celtic troops, whom the Carthaginians began to take under their wing, train and form into a formidable fighting force. At 241 BC, the end of the First Punic War, and about 220 BC, the Carthaginians, especially under the family of the Barcids, the Barca family, are active in Spain. A final ramification of the First Punic War exists on a rather personal level, and I'll end this lecture with a small anecdote that reveals it, that in certain quarters, the defeat by Rome was considered by certain Carthaginians to be a very bitter pill to swallow indeed. They really resented it. They especially resented Rome's seizing of Sardinia and Corsica when the Carthaginians' backs were turned, basically trying to fight their own mercenary troops. The story goes that one Carthaginian general, a man called Hamilcar Barca, a member of the family who was busy in Spain, when he was about to set off for his command in Spain to help extend Carthaginian interest there, was, as one would do in the ancient pagan world, as you're about to embark on a new endeavor, sacrificing to the Carthaginian gods. Hamilcar had a son. The son was at that stage only about 9 or 10 years of age. The son desperately wanted to join his daddy on the new adventures in Spain. His father said, "If you want to come with me, you must come up to the altar and take an oath with me to our ancestral gods." Hamilcar brought his son up to the altar and forced him to swear on the ancestral gods of the Carthaginians that he would never be a friend of the Roman people. Hamilcar's son was named Hannibal, and he was to be one of the greatest banes in Roman history. In fact, he was to lead the Carthaginians to great glory in Spain, but to even further glory in Italy, when, in the next lecture we'll see, he invaded Italy in the course of the Second Punic War, that's also quite rightfully called the Hannibalic War. That is the focus of our next lecture.
These lectures are part of the Great Courses series. They are produced by the Teaching Company. These lectures are titled The History of Ancient Rome, Part 2. Lecture 13, The Second Punic or Hannibalic War.
Welcome to the 13th lecture in the history of ancient Rome with the Teaching Company. We have examined so far the rise of Rome to power in Italy, and in the last lecture, the first conflict between Rome and Carthage, the First Punic War, which drew Rome outside of the Italian peninsula and forced Carthage out of its traditional zone of activity in the Tyrrhenian Sea and westward in the direction of Spain. We ended the lecture by noting how the Carthaginians were busy between 241 and about 220 BC carving an empire for themselves in the southeastern part of Spain. And what I want to do today is pick up on what the Romans were doing during the same period. They weren't sitting around twiddling their thumbs, they were busy as well. And then look at how Spain and Carthaginian expansion in Spain proved to be the spark for the second major conflict between Rome and Carthage, the Second Punic War, which took a very different course indeed from the first one. While the Carthaginians were busy in Spain, the Romans found themselves involved initially across the other side of the Italian peninsula, across the Adriatic Sea, in the area known to them as Illyria, which would, in modern terms, would be former Yugoslavia, parts of Bosnia, Croatia, across the Adriatic from the eastern seaboard of Sicily. Here, a colourful figure, a pirate queen, Queen Teuta, was busy threatening Roman coastal security And so the Romans found themselves engaged in operations against her. And in 229 BC, they declared that region of the Adriatic under their protection. They didn't annex it as a province, the same way that they had done with Sicily and Sardinia and Corsica previously. They just declared it a protectorate of Rome, whatever that meant. Next, in the later part of the 220s, the Romans found themselves involved with the Gauls of the Po Valley. It will be remembered that out of the Po Valley had emerged the Gallic menace that had sacked Rome in 390 BC. The Romans had not forgotten this. They believed that another force was building among the Gauls of the Po Valley, of Gallia Cisalpina, as they called it, to invade Italy. So they took what we would term today a proactive approach and invaded Cisalpine Gaul in 225, defeated the Gauls, and eventually annexed the whole region as a province. In 220 BC, they added yet another province to their expanding territory, which they called Gallia Cisalpina, Gaul this side of the Alps. That was now added to Roman territory. While all this was going on, as we've said before, the Carthaginians were busy in Spain, and the Romans didn't seem to pay much attention to them until the middle of the 220s BC, around the time that they were busy in Gaul. It finally appears to have struck the Romans that the Carthaginians had formed quite a powerful power base for themselves in Spain. The main leader for the Carthaginian side in Spain were the Barca families, initially Hamilcar Barca, then his son-in-law Hasdrubal, and finally his son Hannibal, who between them had formed this very powerful power base for the Carthaginians in Spain. And at some stage the Romans began to get involved in monitoring that situation. Now the details of the Carthaginian and Roman diplomatic maneuvers about the situation in Spain are very uncertain. They're crucially important to understanding the outbreak of the Second Punic War, but they're very uncertain. And in fact, I mentioned them earlier as an example of how uncertainty abounds in ancient history about matters that are actually quite crucial. And this is a good example. We hear from Polybius that when Hasdrubal was commander in Spain, that would be between 229 and 221 BC, a Roman delegation reached an agreement with the Carthaginians about spheres of influence in Spain. It's noteworthy that Polybius calls it an agreement as opposed to a treaty. He uses a different word to describe this arrangement than he uses for formal treaties. All he says of the agreement, the only stipulation that we hear for this agreement, is that the Carthaginians shall not pass the river Iber in arms. That's all we hear. So it seems to have been the demarcation of spheres of influence. Debate has raged. What is the river Ebro? The best candidate is the river Ebro in northeastern Spain, and this is generally accepted as the river in question, and so it's often referred to as the Ebro Treaty, the Treaty of the River Ebro. Notice that all the treaty says, at least all we hear of it saying, is that the Carthaginians shall not move north of the river. It doesn't say expressly that the Romans will not move south of the river under arms, but presumably that was the other half of the agreement. So there's one aspect of the question. It's not exactly clear when this agreement was reached. Most authorities today would vouch for a date around 226 BC. At some stage, whether it was before or after this agreement was reached, again, is unclear, the Romans took into their friendship, into their fides, into their sphere of influence, a native town called Saguntum on the eastern coast of Spain. This town was quite clearly in the midst of Carthaginian territory and was very much south of the river Ebro, assuming that that is the river that was the subject of the agreement between Carthage and Rome in Spain. Again, when this treaty, or when this arrangement with Saguntum took place is unclear, and it would be crucial to know whether it was before or after the agreement with Carthage had been reached. Whatever the case, the bringing of Saguntum into the sphere of influence of the Romans was to in fact provide the spark for the Second Punic War. Because within Saguntum there were pro-Carthaginian and pro-Roman factions. They fought each other. When the pro-Romans found themselves in trouble, they appealed to their masters. The Romans sent assistance. The Carthaginian general since 221 BC in Spain was Hannibal. He took exception to this and besieged the town of Saguntum in 219 BC. Since the town of Saguntum was in Roman fides, was now a friend of the Roman people, the Romans demanded that Hannibal withdraw. In fact, they demanded that he be handed over to them for trial as a criminal. The Carthaginians refused to hand him over, and war was declared in 218 BC. The Romans prepared for the Second Punic War as if they were going to fight the First Punic War all over. They began building up their navy, and they expected to send an invasion force over to Africa and make a quick job of the Carthaginians. Unfortunately for them, however, they faced in Hannibal one of the world's greatest military geniuses, who seized the initiative in the war in an extremely bold move. Leaving Spain with an army of about 40,000 combined Gauls and Spaniards and Carthaginians, he marched across the Pyrenees. He then marched across hostile territory in southern France. The Romans had got word that a Carthaginian force was coming overland through France and had sent an army up to intercept it, but Hannibal gave that army the slip, crossed the Rhone River, which was some achievement in itself, considering he had 60 elephants in train. Then, remarkably, over a period of about 3 weeks, in October to November of 218 BC, Hannibal led this army across the Alps. This was something that the Romans appeared to have considered impossible to do, to bring a fully organized force, fully disciplined force, let alone a force that was encumbered with elephants, across the Alps into Italy. The Alps were, at this stage, of course, largely uncharted. You must imagine the scale of this achievement, bringing an army across these largely uncharted mountains. In many places, Hannibal had to build his own roads to allow his army to pass, and they were full of hostile Celtic tribes who took every opportunity to attack him, trying to rob his troops of their armor and so on, and enslave the men. So it was an extremely difficult crossing, and the net result that was Hannibal was that when Hannibal emerged out of the Alpine foothills into the Po Valley in the late winter of 218 BC, he had, of his original 40,000 troops, perhaps 26,000 left, and he'd lost all but 20 of his elephants. 26,000 men and 20 elephants is not an awful lot of power to challenge the Confederation of Italy under Rome with, but it was Hannibal's genius that shone through in the subsequent years. After defeating a small Roman force sent against him at the Battle of Ticinus, Hannibal, the following year, crushed a larger Roman force at the Battle of Trebia. It's estimated that the Romans lost perhaps 30,000 men in an afternoon in that battle. That's a casualty rate of 75%. The year after that was even worse. Hannibal's army, now greatly strengthened by defections from the Gauls. Remember, the Gauls of the Po Valley had just been subdued by the Romans only less than 10 years previously, and so when Hannibal defeated the Romans at the Battle of Trebia, they flocked to his standards, swelling his ranks. And the whole mass of enemy troops now moved into Tuscany, moved into ancient Etruria, approaching Rome itself. A Roman consular army sent to defeat Hannibal was stupidly, in many ways, caught whilst crossing beside Lake Trasimene, crossing a small narrow defile beside a lake, a narrow pathway flanked on one side by the lake and on the other by grass-covered hills. In those hills, Hannibal hid his army, and when the Roman army was strung out along this narrow track between the lake and the hills, he ordered his men to attack. The Roman army and its leader were annihilated, 15,000 men killed on that occasion. The Romans at this stage were panicked. They had, however, in their arsenal, in their constitutional arsenal, a provision for such an occasion, which we've already noted, the dictatorship. They declared in 217 BC, following the catastrophe at Trasimene, a dictator. The man they chose was an old senator, Quintus Fabius Maximus, who figured that Hannibal should not be assaulted head-on again for some time. The best policy, according to Fabius, was to contain Hannibal while the Romans dealt with the Carthaginians in other spheres of the war. These so-called Fabian tactics earned Quintus Fabius Maximus a further name, Cunctator, the Delayer. And for the next year or so, Hannibal's army had free rein in Italy, while a Roman army shadowed it, tried to hem it in, limit its activities. If Hannibal sent out foraging parties, they would be attacked. so forth, basically harrying, harassing the Carthaginian forces, but not engaging them in open battle. The following year, the dictatorship of Fabius lapsed, and the Romans grew impatient. Two new young consuls, hot-headed consuls, came to power, and promising that they would crush Hannibal by sheer force of numbers. From the Roman Confederation, they raised a vast army, a double consular army, probably in the range of 70 to 80,000 men, the largest single army the Romans had yet raised, and marched it off, no doubt amid scenes of great pomp and grandeur, out of Rome to attack Hannibal in South Italy, who was now camped in South Italy. At a place called Cannae, the two armies faced each other on a plain. Hannibal's army outnumbered perhaps 2-1. Hannibal knew the Roman tactics. Their method was to smash through the center of an opposing army, break the line, and then destroy the enemy forces. Seeing that his army was greatly outnumbered, he conceived of one of the greatest military tactics that we have on record, one that is still used. General Norman Schwarzkopf says that he used this, basically this Hannibalic tactic at Cannae in his 100-hour campaign against Iraq in the Gulf War in 1990. Hannibal weakened his center and ordered it to retreat in the face of what he knew would be the Roman onslaught on his center. He strengthened his two flanks with his best troops. And when the attack came, sure enough, the Roman legions surged forward towards the center of Hannibal's lines, which then yielded in front of him. And as this happened, the Romans found themselves drawn into a pocket with stronger flanks coming around behind them. Eventually, the Romans were so packed together that they could no longer so much as draw their swords, let alone use them. And the Carthaginian cavalry and flanks spread out behind them, completely enveloping the Roman army. The rest of the day was spent in pure butchery. Estimates of Roman losses vary from 45 to 70,000 men killed in a single day. Can you imagine the scene on the battlefield afterwards? It must have been something unbelievable. Carthaginian losses were minimal. Between these three battles, Trebia, Trasimene, and Cannae, the Romans had lost perhaps 100,000 troops to the Carthaginian onslaught. In any normal ancient state, this would have required them to negotiate a peace. But because of the nature of the Romans and because of the support of their allies, who stood unwaveringly beside them in this time of crisis, the Romans did nothing of the sort. Far from it. One of the consuls at Cannae was killed, last seen sitting on a rock, head bowed, bleeding profusely. But the other consul, Marcus Terentius Varro, returned to the city on a horse, haggard, blood-spattered, dusty. Upon entering the Senate, we are told, the Senate stood and applauded him. An official resolution was passed thanking the consul for not despairing of the Republic and for doing his duty as best he could. Contrast that with the way the Carthaginians treated their generals who failed in their efforts. They were crucified. The image and attitude of the Romans in this time of crisis is to stand firm, yield nothing. Hannibal, however, was unable to press home his advantage after Cannae. This great crushing defeat, which really should have been decisive in the war, proved to be not decisive at all. He showed his overall strategy by his treatment of Roman captives. Remember, half of all Roman armies at this period were made up of Italians. Hannibal generally would enslave or execute Romans who came to within, who fell within his power, who became captives, but he would always release the Italians. And it seems that his strategy was to essentially dissolve the Roman Confederacy of Italy, to lure Rome's allies away from their loyalty to Rome and thus destroy Roman power in Italy for good. He couldn't actually attack Rome itself. He didn't have the siege equipment that was available to him. He didn't have particularly good experience in siege warfare. And what's more, it's very hard to prosecute a siege without considerable local support. A siege is a long, drawn-out business. If you have hostile communities all around you, it's very hard for you to conduct a siege of a well-defended city like Rome. So Hannibal had to first detach the Confederate allies from Rome before he could even contemplate laying siege to the city itself. The allies did not budge. Some of the newly incorporated communities of South Italy, some of the Greek communities, Capua for instance, did defect over to Hannibal. But the core of the Roman heartland in central Italy, Latium, Samnium, and so forth, these places, not one of them opened their doors to Hannibal. As a result then, despite his early successes, and once the Romans had learned their lesson from Cannae and reverted to Fabian-style tactics, Hannibal stomped about Italy for the next 12 years or so to no great effect. He became little more than an irritant. He would destroy crops and so forth, but he did not threaten. He didn't determine the course of the war in any decisive way after the Battle of Cannae. Really, what should have been his finest moment turned out to be nothing in particular. Instead, and remarkably, even as their existence and their sway over their Italian homeland was being threatened at home, the Romans were conducting campaigns in other theatres of the Mediterranean. They were fighting Carthaginian forces in Spain. The objective of the Roman forces there was to prevent Hannibal from being reinforced over land. They still had complete naval superiority, and so Hannibal could not be reinforced by sea. But there was a threat that maybe Carthaginian armies might follow in the footsteps of Hannibal and reinforce him in Italy, which may have been a problem. So the objective of the Roman forces in Spain was to break Carthaginian power there. Campaigns were marked by several successes and defeats, but in 211 BC, things came to a nasty head when the Romans lost two major battles in Spain, and it looked like they had lost the war in Spain. Besides Spain, they were also fighting Syracuse in Sicily. Syracuse, after the Battle of Cannae, had rather hastily and impetuously decided to side themselves with Hannibal. As soon as this had happened, they found themselves facing a Roman army sent against them. The city was besieged and finally captured in 211 BC, with probably the most famous victim of that siege being Archimedes, the famous mathematician who was in Syracuse, had helped the Syracusans organize their defense against the Romans and was killed, we hear, killed by a Roman soldier while he was still drawing geometric designs and doing equations in the sand. Whether that's true or not is quite a separate story, but it is a colorful one. So even as the Romans were being successful in Sicily, their forces in Spain looked like they had been decimated. But just at this time, this is one of those moments in history where things can go either way, just at that time, out of the midst of their aristocracy emerged a man who was the equal of Hannibal in military ability. His name was Publius Cornelius Scipio. He was, in 211 BC, merely 25 years of age. But he had tremendous charisma, powerful abilities in oratory, and he convinced the people that, given a chance, he could reverse the Roman situation in Spain and help bring the war to an end. Despite having held no office prior to this and being, by Roman standards, a mere stripling, he was given the governorship, or a extended command, in Spain and led a large army over there in 210 BC. Within 3 years, he had defeated Carthaginian forces in Spain and secured the place for Rome. The last gasp of the Carthaginian offensive effort in the war, took place in northern Italy. Hannibal's brother, Hasdrubal by name, had broken out of Spain, had evaded Scipio's trap in Spain, and had followed his brother's footsteps all the way across the Pyrenees, through southern France, and across the Alps, into northern Italy. His army, however, was intercepted in north Italy at the river Metaurus, and defeated in 207 BC. Hannibal's last chance of being reinforced ended at that moment. Hannibal, by the way, found out that his brother had lost that battle, had failed to reach him, when his brother's head was thrown over the ramparts of his camp following the defeat of Hasdrubal at Metaurus. Young Scipio, now flush with his victory from Spain, now returned to Rome and began advocating an invasion of Africa to draw Hannibal out of Italy. He said, this situation must end. Hannibal has been around now for too long. The only way to get it out of Italy is to threaten the Carthaginian homeland. Many opposed this view, feeling it was hasty, and that as long as an enemy force was still on Italian soil, it would be reckless indeed to send a really major Roman force over to try and invade Carthage. But Scipio convinced the people that he was correct, and sent a large army over, well, led a large army over to Africa in 204 BC and began attacking Carthaginian forces there. Sure enough, the ploy worked, and Hannibal was drawn out of Italy, recalled by his superiors to defend the homeland. And he returned in 203 BC and faced Scipio in Africa at the Battle of Zama in 202 BC. This is a very dramatic